Welcome! The German club season has come to a close. Matt Ford was in Kiel to catch the second leg of the relegation playoff and bumped into a rather interesting Holstein Kiel fan. But to his team's performance define their season? Also, Frankfurt won their first trophy in 3 decades after beating Bayern Munich in the German Cup. What does it mean for the Bundesliga champions and their new coach, Niko Kovac? And we also discuss Borussia Dortmund's new head coach, Lucien Favre. This is Tribuna Weekly. So Wolfsburg won the relegation playoff over Holstein Kiel, beating them 4-1 over 2 legs. Matt Ford was in Kiel for the second leg and caught up with a Holstein Kiel fan named Matthias, who has his own football food blog. They discussed in-stadium food options and what it means for Holstein Kiel to be in the relegation playoff.
Before we get on to talking about Holstein Kiel, we're going to talk about a blog that Matthias has been running, and you're going to be telling us a little bit about it. I think it's quite interesting because you've been combining football and travelling watching football with something a bit unusual, I think, with cooking and cuisine. So tell us a little bit about it. What's it called and when did you start it and why?
We started the blog in 2009, and the idea behind it, the name is Calcio Culinaria, which sort of is Italian football and
cuisine.
Food. And the thing is that the stadium catering in the Holstein Stadium wasn't very good by that time, and there was no regional aspect. In some stadiums in France you get baguette, in England you get pies, in Sweden you get hot dogs, but here in Kiel no regional beer, no good sausage. We thought there must be better stadium food somewhere out there, and so we started traveling through Germany and through Europe, and we tried the stadium food in every stadium, and also regional specialties. And for example, in Sweden you have a fish called surströmming. It's fermented fish, and
they eat that in the stadium.
In the stadium, and I thought, okay, there are some people eating it, so it can't be too bad. But it was the worst thing I ever tasted in my whole life. I can't describe it. It hurt on the tongue.
Okay.
And I wanted to eat something else, and I got some crisps with a very strong flavor, but it didn't help. And it was really the worst thing I ever tasted.
So that inspired you to do something better for Holstein Kiel home games.
We want to have fish in the stadium. Many fans want to have fish in the stadium, and as we are at the Baltic Sea, but they don't sell it here. And I think that's bad because people come to Kiel for football, and they are only like 90 minutes in this town. And they want to have something that is typical for our region. And at least since last summer, we have a regional beer. So that's okay, but...
always starting with the most important things.
in Germany, it's all about beer. And but we still don't sell anything with fish, so there's enough work to do.
Let's move on to talk about Holstein Kiel. It's been an exciting season, hasn't it? What were your expectations at the start of the season for Holstein Kiel? Did you expect to end up in the playoff for the Bundesliga?
No, I never dreamed of something like that. I always said that I'm so glad to be in the second Bundesliga. I don't want to end up on the last position without any chance. My dream was to end the season in the lower midfield without getting in trouble. But the football they were playing and the success I didn't expect.
Obviously, Holstein Kiel are a Bundesliga 2 team. They were the Dritte Liga team in the third division. What sort of football do Holstein Kiel play? What can we expect from them?
They play very offensive football. They don't care about the opponent. they try to play their match. And we have the top scorer of the league in our team, and there are some other players who also score a lot of goals during the season. I think that's, you know, what the team is playing.
I think in the league, Kiel scored more goals than Nuremberg, who got promoted directly.
Yeah, so. We won. I think we lost. No other teams lost fewer games.
Okay.
And so we had quite a lot draws during one part of the season, but yeah, we had. Such tremendous matches.
So after that season, what were the opinions of the Kiel fans here approaching the playoff? Do people really want to go up, or do people think maybe it's a bit too soon? Or
I think that's hard to say. I think it's each medal has two sides, and
yeah.
The money we could use for building or rebuilding the stadium, so that would be definitely good to get promoted.
A huge financial benefit just to be in the Bundesliga for one season.
Yeah, and I think everyone's thankful that we play in the second Bundesliga, and if we go up, it would be a dream. No team from Schleswig-Holstein ever played in the Bundesliga before, and some years it's. Not too many years ago, Holstein had a stadium which was more like a ruin, and they were playing in the fifth division, and the football was not attractive. No one, even in Kiel, really loved the club. But then everything changed, and many people know about the last 30 years. The last 30 years, it was always hard to be a Holstein Kiel fan. And I think thankful is the right word right now. And if we are going up, okay, we will celebrate. But if we do not get promoted,
it's not the worst thing in the world.
No, we are still playing second Bundesliga.
That's still a dream for many of the people.
Yeah, that's most of most people dreamed of that in the last years. So, yeah.
One of the people who's been responsible for that is the coach, Markus Anfang, and of course he's leaving at the end of the season to go to Cologne. What can fans of Cologne expect from him? Is he the right coach to take them back to the Bundesliga after their relegation?
I don't know, because I think Kiel is a special club. You can work here without too many big newspapers in the back who are criticizing you when you're losing a match. But I think Markus Anfang did really good work here in Kiel. He had his own idea about playing football, and after some weeks at Thirst, I think the team wasn't ready and the fans weren't ready too. But then the people realized what he's doing, and it was successful, and he took us to the second Bundesliga, he took us here, so maybe he's the right coach for Cologne.
Obviously now Holstein Kiel find themselves in a playoff, and as we said, in Germany it works, the third top from the second division plays against the third bottom from the Bundesliga in a two-legged playoff. I think people have different opinions on that, don't they? I've heard some people saying, oh, it's a bit unfair because historically, since it was reintroduced, only two second division teams have ever actually beaten the first division team. That was Nuremberg and Fortuna Düsseldorf. Normally, it's the Division 1 team that wins. Obviously, Hamburg twice, famously. Wolfsburg last year and potentially again this year as well. On the other hand, some people think it's exciting. It's a nice reward for the Division 2 team to have a chance to test themselves against a top division team. What's your opinion on that? Do you think it's a good idea, or would you change it?
For me, these two matches are a bonus, and I would like to get promoted on the third place. But it is like it is. So we have to face the relegation promotion matches, and yeah, I think it would be fairer if we go up without promotion relegation games, but yeah, I can't change it.
some of the fans we were speaking to earlier said that they actually see it the other way around. They see it as a reward, and they're quite, you know, they see it as exciting to finally to play a game at the end of the season against a Bundesliga team and to really test how far they've come, although they don't really have much of a chance of going up. So it's quite difficult, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But without the relegation promotion, you would get the reward to play every weekend against a Bundesliga team. So it doesn't make sense. But I think it's okay to play them. And because we had such a great season, we have two more matches to celebrate the team. And if we get promoted, yeah, we will celebrate even harder.
Do you think that Holstein Kiel have a chance of getting promoted after getting beaten 3-1 in the first leg?
It's really hard, but there's always a chance.
Well, we'll see how it goes. Matthias from Calcio Culinaria, thank you for your time.
Yeah.
That was Matt Ford in Kiel, and now Matt is in the studio with Jonathan Harding back from his vacation to the United States. First, I have to ask Matt, what was your experience of the playoff? You didn't go to the first leg in Wolfsburg, but you did go to see the very small, not Bundesliga-approved stadium in Kiel.
Well, yeah, ultimately it was Bundesliga-approved, wasn't it? And then all that was missing in the end was Holstein Kiel to actually do it and sporting-wise, get themselves there. And I think, rightly so, yeah, the discussions before the game ranged a lot about this decision with the DFB, saying, no, you can't play with that stadium because I think although three sides of it are covered, one side where the Wolfsburg fans were stood was an old terrace, which I think must have been there from the original building
of
the ground. from back in the 1900s, 1910s or something, that, you know, the most old school sort of stadium you can imagine. But yeah, I think the right decision was reached in the end, and had they managed to get through and played in the Bundesliga, it's only right if you qualified to play there, then you play there, and that would have been interesting for a lot of Bundesliga teams. Obviously it wasn't quite enough to put off Wolfsburg on the night. Don't think they were particularly impressive again either, but then again they had a 3-1 lead from the first leg, so they didn't need to attack. They had nothing to prove. They had a 2-goal lead against a team which was in Division 3 season before last. So what did they have to do? Kiel, as
the game
them,
was entertaining, though.
I found it entertaining. I thought the atmosphere was fantastic. I thought Kiel performed how we expected them to. There was a bit of a shock before kickoff that was it Dominic Drexler, is their main playmaker.
Yeah, that was a shame.
Was left out of the squad, apparently injured. And I'm not entirely sure what's happened with that, but they didn't seem to miss him as far as I was concerned. A free-flowing attacking 4-1-4-1 formation, and they caused Wolfsburg problems. And maybe with a little bit more calmness up front, a little bit more experience, who knows, a couple of those chances may have gone in, and it would have been a different story. But as it was, the atmosphere around town all day was fantastic. The place was absolutely buzzing for it. It was a bank holiday, so people were walking around and enjoying the sunshine down the port in Kiel, even dressed as sailors, as they do. He's obviously being a former naval city, so all a good day out. None of the fans expected the team to get through, which is quite interesting really, because that made them actually quite excited about the relegation playoff, or the promotion playoff from their point of view.
Yeah. We do forget that, this is basically a third division team last year that is playing a Bundesliga team in a non-cup competition, in a league competition that matters.
Well, it reminded you more of a cup competition, to be honest.
Yeah?
Yeah, it did. It felt a bit like the first or second round of the German Cup. Such was the location, such were the surroundings, and such were the discrepancies between the teams, both in terms of experience, in terms of money, in terms of stadium, in terms of fan base. In terms of coaches, there was a dispute after the game between Marcus Anfang and Bruno Labbadia. I think some words were exchanged. Labbadia accused Anfang of a lack of respect after Anfang had suggested that he thought Kiel should have won the game. Arguably, yeah, maybe they should. Perhaps they did have the best of it, but over the two legs, I don't really think we can complain about Wolfsburg having deserved it, although Kiel never really had a chance at all, I suppose.
Yeah, Jonathan, on that point, we rewind a year, and you and I were walking on our way to see the Mittel Rhein-Pokal final in Sportpark Nord in Bonn, and we were talking about Braunschweig playing Wolfsburg, and the first thing that you said to me was, it should be 3 up, 3 down. They need to have more turnover in the Bundesliga. Now, before the podcast today, you made the point that, I mean, if that was the case, I mean, the leagues are just smaller than they are in all over Europe. I mean, there's 18 teams in the top two division. In England, there's 20 teams in the top division, 24 teams in the second division. In Italy, I believe it's 2020. And in France, it's 2020. And in Spain, it's 2020. Do you feel differently today than you did a year ago?
No, I think the same issue has come up. I think, you know, Matt touched on it in his piece after the game, that the biggest issue for the playoff format at the moment is that it's completely favorable for the Bundesliga side. And unfortunately, mediocrity continues to be rewarded. There was no way that Wolfsburg were not going to win this over two legs. And that says a lot considering how bad Wolfsburg have been this season. I think the problem with the second division is that if you open it up, as people have suggested, to the English format of saying that the top two go up and then 3, 4, 5, 6 play a playoff.
Yeah, Matt suggested that last week, yeah.
That you potentially have the side in sixth in an 18-team division going up,
yeah.
Which is problematic just from a quality level, because the second division always has two teams, normally the two teams that are relegated, that are miles better than everybody else. Really, I mean, on the whole,
that's been more the case recently. I think there was always one promoted team that would immediately go down. That trend has kind of been different the last few years.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure Johnny Walsh, if he does listen to this, will pull me up on some fantastic second division stats about promotion and relegation. But you know, the fact of the matter is, Cologne and Hamburg will be favourites to go straight back up next season, I think. Given the money, given the clubs, given the situations, given the coaches as well, right? Anfang and Titz are both exciting coaches in terms of the direction that they've got this side playing. So that means that the other 16 teams in the division are already at a disadvantage. And if you look at this season, Nuremberg and Dusseldorf, I think, far and away, the best two teams in the division. Kiel, really the surprise, being in third, as you guys just said, basically a third division team. And so the problem with that format, the 3, 4, 5, 6 playoff round like we have in England, is that you can't open up the door for the side in sixth, I don't think. As much as I'd like to see it.
There's a big difference between sixth in a second division. In a 24 team league.
Oh, massively.
And sixth in an 18 team league.
Yeah, I did the math briefly. I mean, just with the 3 up, 3 down concept.
That's something that I would much prefer, because if you think about that in recent seasons, that means you would have got rid of Hamburg. You would have got rid of Wolfsburg, and that cycle is at least fair. The only problem with that is that if you have a team like Kiel, then if Kiel had come up and a 3 up, 3 down, they'd be in the Bundesliga next season. That would have been an enormous struggle.
They would have been cannon fodder every single week.
Absolutely battered.
I understand the argument, but I think the argument against that would be to say that if you look at the way, I think this is the way I see it, the way it's worked in the Championship in England, is that the longer that system goes on, though, the more money and money experience comes back down, and there's over the years you do have a steadily growing base of second tier clubs who have at least over the past 10 years experienced 1, 2, maybe 3 years of top flight football with all the financial benefits and infrastructural benefits that come with it, which would mean that necessarily over the course of time it wouldn't always be a case that, oh right, we've got a third team such as a Holstein Kiel and Union Berlin or going up, because the third team eventually over the course of time would actually be better qualified and in a better place to hold on.
But
so
I think the question is, though, is that better for the team in the short term? Because you just said, Kiel goes up and gets battered.
Yeah, it'd be difficult. It'd be difficult for 3 or 4 years, yeah, because the team is going up. Well, yeah,
are the financial benefits of the Bundesliga so great? Because obviously in the Premier League, it's ridiculous. You can go down and be relegated and have $100 million. Your parachute payments are enormous.
There's no comparison to that, but the goal... Yeah,
look at Darmstadt, though. The Gulf is still...
I've got the figures to hand, but the Gulf is still sizeable between the first and second division. Over the course of time, I think it would even itself out a little bit. But then you're still talking about the third place in an 18 team league going up directly. Maybe it should just be two up, two down directly. And
maybe that's like, the other way to do so, it. No one suggested that.
But,
yeah.
But Matt, you wrote a piece from Kiel, and you mentioned this on the podcast last week that. And I think is a really good point that Jonathan, I want you to comment on. You said that basically the Holstein Kiel played a 34 game season, and their season is defined by playing a two-legged tie against a team that wasn't even in their league.
Yeah,
do you think that is fair?
Well, that's definitely problematic.
I think it's wrong on principle. I think your promotion should be measured on what you've achieved across a 34 game season against teams in your league. Yeah. That's the competition. That's the aim of the game. Suddenly saying that, all right, well done. You've done really, really well in your competition. You've maybe not won your competition, but performed extremely well in it. But before you get your reward, beat them as well. It's like, well, they're nothing to do with my competition.
Imagine if some of the sides in the Championship in England had to play sides in the Premier League after playing 46 games in the second division. I think that there would be a lot of protest in response to that. And I think that's a valid point. You shouldn't have to play a side that you've had nothing to do with all season.
The argument works.
I quite like the two up, two down.
The argument works the other way as well, like looking at it from the point of view of the Bundesliga team. I heard a few people I was talking to in Kiel saying that maybe it's actually quite fair on Wolfsburg and Hamburg in previous years, that they've finally got a second chance, a final chance to save themselves, and they deserve that. I don't see it that way personally. No, okay. I think you've over 34 games, you've failed.
Yeah.
Why should you? I read an article one point where the analogy used was, why should you have a life ring then thrown to you in the form of a team that's not from your league, that's from a league lower than you, in order to save you after you failed over 34 games? I do find that in principle wrong.
But the problem with the entire situation in terms of, you know, up and down, we talked about playing teams in other divisions, you know, it's this situation that this season in the Bundesliga has been a really mediocre season for a lot of teams. You know, we talked about inconsistency even in the top eight.
We've been talking about it in the second division
too.
Yeah,
absolutely, right? And that is a real problem for German football at the moment. The number of times we've been on the pod this season and said, why haven't Leverkusen been good enough this week? They've just won 3 on the bounce, they've lost 3 on the bounce. This inconsistency is a problem for the entire league. And I think if you start rewarding sides that are consistently inconsistent, aka Wolfsburg, Hamburg, all of those sides down there, then this last chance saloon is a really dangerous option, because it basically says to them, you can be crap over 34 games, but you know what? Here's Kiel. You can beat them.
Well, and with all due respect to Kiel, it's one of the reasons they were able to stay in third all that time. There were numerous occasions throughout the second division season where even when third place Kiel lost a game, everyone else went and lost as well. And I think as great as the achievement from Marcus Anfang and his Kiel side is, and as attractive and impressive as the football is, and all due respect to them for that, I think the fact they came third probably says more about the rest of the league than it does about them.
I think that's the problem with the modus. You know, how would you change it going forward? I like the two up, two down, but I think the problem with that is that you feed into the inevitability that the sides relegated from the Bundesliga will just be in almost a permanent loop of going back up. So I think, you know, given that it's probably a bit too dangerous, even in the long term, to offer the playoff modus we know in England, I think three up, three down is probably not a bad idea, because even if this season, you use it as an example, Kiel had gone up and they'd have been cannon fodder next year, Matt's right, over the course of a decade, that's maybe four or five sides that will have more money, better stadium. You know, that's a positive for German football because you need other teams.
It spreads the money around a bit better, yeah.
All right, so with all due respect to the relegation playoff, there was a little bit bigger of a game that happened over this Pfingsten weekend here in Germany, and that was the German Cup final. And the game was 90 minutes long, but it was what happened in second half stoppage time that almost defined the entire game. For those of you who missed it, there was a...
How many of them are you?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, me for one.
Yeah, exactly.
You were a different cup final.
Javi Martinez basically took the ball down in the box in the second minute of stoppage time. And as Jonathan so eloquently described before we went on the podcast, basically Kevin Prince Boateng tries to clear it away and instead ends up clearing Javi Martinez's ankle away. VAR was used in this instant. But I want to first start with, before we get into the VAR discussion, I want to first get to this discussion. Jonathan, obviously you were played as a defender. Can you explain why this was a penalty?
Well, I don't think you have to be a defender to...
Was it that clear cut?
I don't think you have to have been a defender to know that this was a penalty. I think anybody with a decent pair of eyes would have said that this was a penalty. I think it's very clear cut. And I think what's difficult for a number of... this is a very complicated situation.
Yeah.
It's a cup final. It's the 93rd minute of the game. Bayern Munich are losing 2-1. This is a decision for Bayern Munich in a season, across a season where many decisions have gone Bayern Munich's way. You have a technology that is supposed to make the game fairer.
We'll get to the technology, yeah.
Absolutely. These are all factors playing into this situation. Mm-hmm. But even if you had none of that, Kevin Prince-Boateng does not get the ball in the box and he clips the foot of an opposing player. Now, just on a very basic level, that's a foul.
True, but so I'm the reason why I ask this is because I'm of two minds here. I think it would have been a rather soft penalty to give. It by the letter of the law, it is a penalty.
Yeah, but that's exactly it, though, isn't it? I mean, we can talk about.
So that's the other mind that I have is that if this happened in midfield, this would have been a foul. So if it's happening in the box, then why isn't it a foul?
And that's exactly the point. You know, we say it often enough about fouls. If this is a foul here, then you know it's given. If it's anywhere else, it you know that's the problem. You can't have that conversation. It can't be if it's outside the box, it's given. If it's inside, it's not. If it's a foul, it's a foul. And I think what's frustrating and perhaps even confusing is that the referee, Felix Weyer, in that situation, doesn't decide to give the penalty. VAR does come in, yeah? And then you have all this confusion, right?
So let's get to VAR, though, because this was the second minute of stoppage time. This has obviously never happened before, but this is in added time. How much stoppage time was there actually?
I think there were 4 minutes.
Yeah, so there was. So basically, we're halfway through stoppage time. Is it a wise use of the rest of stoppage time to go to VAR and look at
it?
He
has to get it right. It doesn't matter.
Right, but I'm just because I think these are two separate discussions. That's what I'm trying to define here. Because I think that this is not a VAR discussion. And I think that
no, it's a referee discussion.
I think that there has been some chatter that I've seen on social media making this a VAR discussion.
No, the reason that it might be seen as a VAR decision is because VAR was used in this situation. But actually, you know, we come back to the referee's decision, and it's
right.
The referee that decides. He decided it wasn't a penalty. He was told to review the situation. He reviewed it, and still decided it wasn't a penalty.
Right
now. The confusion there is, if he's seen the same pictures that we have, how can he make that decision knowing the laws of the game like he should?
Now,
because
Matt,
it's his profession.
Matt, it's interesting because...
Now, while I agree lots of Frankfurt fans don't care, and I think actually point is probably lots of German football fans don't care because Bayern Munich.
But Felix Weyer came out and he in comments in Kicker, and he said that... not only does he stand by his decision, but he also explained how he made the decision. He only he he only looked at it from one angle, which was the goal line cam. And if I remember the comments correctly, he mostly looked at it in real time. He did not look at it in slow motion like we would see on television. Is that how you would want the video? I mean, I know that you're not a huge fan of video assistant referee, but is that how you would want a decision to be made in real time and not in the slowdown?
No, I think if the technology is there and it's part of the game and it's been introduced and it's at the referee's disposal and there he is looking at it in stoppage time there on the side of the pitch, then he should be using all the possibilities that are open to him. So if he's come out and said that he only saw one angle when there were clearly others available, I don't understand why he's not seeing the others. On the other hand, I think we've had the argument a few times, say that, well, if he looked at it in slow motion, would it look worse? And perhaps that thought has entered his head as well, that maybe he's thought, well, if I look at the slow motion version, it's probably it might look worse to me, I might give it. So I do find that baffling. I think it's interesting that the subjectivity has just remained in it, because as much, John said he thinks it's a pen. I think it's a pen. You think it's a pen. Everyone thinks it's a pen. Felix Vieira thinks it's not. By the letter of the law, yeah, we've seen a load of angles and think, yeah, surely if we apply the laws to that situation, then that's a foul. And like you said, rightly, yeah, probably elsewhere on the pitch it would have been given. But we were having that discussion before the AR even came on the radar.
We've been having that discussion for years.
Fouls being given outside the area, but not in. So VAR's changed nothing there. And yet here we are still sat there, all with a different opinion. Well, not all, two parties, Felix Vieira and the rest of us, but it's enough. Discussing what we all observe subjectively.
But are you willing? Objectively. Are you willing to at least concede that in this instant, As it's laid out, video assistant referee was used correctly in this instance?
I think
the technology itself.
I don't think it was, but then again, we can't be totally sure why he's not seen all the angles that were available to him. Were they made available to him? Did he choose not to view certain angles? Was it even possible to view those angles? If it's the case that those angles were not made available to him, then that to me is a failure on the part of the system and the way it's being used. Why are we having a system? Whether you like it or not, the system's there, so it should be used properly in its full capabilities.
Yeah, and I don't
understand that. You mentioned before something to do the timing of it being halfway through stoppage time. For me, that makes that's completely irrelevant as well. The technology is there in the game.
But
wouldn't you
want it to be if this is a huge decision, this could be an equalizer for Bayern Munich.
So therefore, it was 2-1 at the time. If it's there, yeah
absolutely. But it's not. That has to. Unfortunately, this is the human aspect of it. Those factors have obviously played a role, I think, in Felix Vieira's decision making. He's obviously very aware that it's the 93rd minute of the game and it's 2-1 to Frankfurt.
That's interesting, because one of the reasons VAR was brought in was
to
eliminate human error.
Yeah,
the influence of human emotion and human fatigue at that point in the game as well.
Exactly.
And the mental pressure he's under, like it's the 93rd minute of a German Cup final. And the technology was supposed to eradicate that. And I understand that argument. However, evidently it's not, has it? Because we're all sat here a couple
talking
of days later discussing it. So now, to me, that's just a fundamental issue with it.
One more question on this, and then we can move on to the actual game. would someone like Dennis Aitekin made a different decision?
Who knows? He's a different human being. So
and that's exactly the point Matt's making.
That's the point. Yeah.
If a different human being, albeit with the same level of qualification as another one in this context, can make a different decision...
Then
using the same technology,
then it renders the point of the introduction.
What is the point of the technology?
Pointless.
If the technology is there to make sure that fairer decisions are made, and that when errors are made, referees are made aware of them, but still, two different referees can make completely different decisions. What's the point in the technology?
We've talked about VAR ad nauseum. This actually is my last question.
It is the most dull topic, isn't it?
What's
football become?
Yeah, but should
replays? It's replays.
This. I'm genuinely curious what your answer is, especially since you're such a big rugby fan.
Oh yes.
Should it be up to Felix Vieira to make that decision?
Oh, absolutely. The referee on the field has to that's the problem,
right?
Isn't
but in rugby, but if there's a try decision that goes to the video, it's not the referee on the field that makes the decision.
No, it's the touchline official. He's the one. It's the fourth official that makes that decision. He's the one who gets to see the replay. But that's because in those moments, he can look at 700 camera angles the same way that a guy can look at 700 camera angles for a foul on Kevin Prince Boateng.
Other people in Germany, other advocates of VAR, who, as far as I know, have always, even its greatest advocates have said, no, the actual final decision making has to remain with the man on the pitch. I don't know if there are people, if there are voices out there suggesting that, decisions should actually be made by teams of people sat in the cellar in Cologne.
Yeah, but I think that's the beginning of the end. If you then say the man on the pitch, and there have been incidences that doesn't have control, doesn't have power, then if players are aware of that, then every single situation will be, I don't care what you say, mate, check with the guy in Cologne.
The square fingers over and over again.
And that's a real problem.
It does open up a bag of worms, definitely.
And that review is normally only ever for tries or clear incidences of foul play where someone has punched someone and you need to take action that the referee might not have been aware of. There are stages of rugby that are completely different to football, which means things can happen off the ball. I think in football, the danger is if you remove the power, if you'd have taken this instance from the cup final and you'd have said, whoever's in the team in Cologne, and they'd have come over the headpiece and said, Felix Weyer, you need to give that penalty, then why do we then you have this problem of, well, what's the point in having a referee out there anyway? Right. And you're caught between the two. You're caught between wanting the technology to make sure that referees can make sound decisions and still giving referees the opportunity to interpret the game the way that they have experienced it and learnt it. And the problem is that the grey area in between that is what we've seen in the cup final here. It's a penalty. I still don't want to give it after technological review.
Right. So there, the other circumstance of that is, why was Bayern Munich trailing 2-1 in second half stoppage time to Eintracht Frankfurt, a team that they have actually handled decently well this season, considering in the past years that Niko Kovac has given them problems?
Oh, Niko Kovac is a vastly underestimated tactician.
He's not underestimated by Bayern Munich, because he's going to be their coach next
absolutely
season.
Absolutely. He put on a masterclass in this cup final, though. I really think he did, and Bayern Munich were caught off guard. I thought that Frankfurt were absolutely excellent, and if you look at the way they played against Bayern on match day 15 in the Bundesliga, it was very similar. They were very aggressive. They crossed loads. They were all over them in the first 20 minutes. But the difference was they didn't score. And then eventually Bayern do what they always do. They wrestle back control. They scored. And they won, I think, 1-0 in that game. But Frankfurt had, more control, more possession. They were the better team. There was the beginnings of a blueprint there on how to beat Bayern Munich. And what Frankfurt did in Berlin was execute that blueprint perfectly.
I called them the anti-Bayern a few weeks ago.
They were assisted, let's make no bones about it, they were assisted by a very sloppy Bayern Munich performance. Yeah. I mean, ball control in pivotal situations, eyes off the ball. There were moments that Bayern looked very un-Bayern. And I think Mats Hummels sort of touched on it after the game, who he has an excellent sense of analysis even in those moments where a lot of players are still very emotional. You're talking about a Bayern Munich whose season is separated into two or three parts. Bundesliga's one, build up to the Champions League. You're just thinking like a month and a half ago, everybody's talking about Bayern for the treble. And actually the defeat to Real Madrid, I think that's the turning point in their season. And since then they've been rubbish, because I don't think they can believe that they, even objectively in the sense, the better team, lost that semi-final. They were the better team. And they lost to a more efficient side who have just stuck around in this competition and been annoying in many respects. Yeah. Since then, Bayern have not been themselves. And that, combined with Frankfurt's game plan to be very, very quick on the break, be brutal on mistakes, to be very efficient. So many sides. We have watched so many sides. Go to Munich in the league season, play really well, and then say afterwards, God, if only they'd scored that chance in the first 20 minutes, and then they get battered 3-1. And Frankfurt didn't let themselves become another team on that list. They were the ones who took the chances when they came.
And Ante Rebic.
Ante Rebic, amazing, especially with Jovic not playing. I was like, wow, this is really impressive. And Boateng up front as well. Excellent performance. Just from back to front, who knew that David Abraham was going to go from Hoffenheim centre-back to Frankfurt's key piece? Things like that. Just really, really impressive performance from Frankfurt. And they executed a game plan.
Matt, and on the Marienplatz, where the Bayern Munich have made an annual tradition of celebrating their titles, they were much more apologetic to their fans because they had only won the Bundesliga title. Now, last year, again, I'm referring to last year because Jonathan was on the podcast last year and he made an interesting point. The Bundesliga is still a pretty big deal, but to the players themselves, this wasn't a successful season. Do you agree?
Given the aims they set for themselves, probably not, and it was underwhelming. And I agree with John that I think the Champions League was definitely the turning point for them.
Would the German Cup made a difference, though?
Yeah, I think it would have done. I think as much as Jupp Heynckes has won absolutely everything in the game, and actually a simple double was actually one thing he never actually did win, as far as I know, at least as a coach. So that would have been a nice...
Well, he kind of did. He
did it with a treble. Never actually a purely simple double on its own. So whether that was an extra thing he wanted to tick off in his list, I don't know. Yeah, it would have been a perfect send-off for him after this. It would have been a nice little pick-up after the disappointment of the Champions League, which I don't think we can underestimate the shock that sent through Bayern Munich. It's been their aim for years. It's the reason Ancelotti lost his job, because that ultimate aim was going to be slipping out of sight. It's one of the reasons they turned to Heynckes, not just because they were lacking other options, but here was a man who's literally been there and done it and could take them there, and it unravelled in rather unfortunate circumstances in Madrid. But the fact that Bayern unravelled slightly towards the end of the season and the air seemed to be sucked out of them, the Stuttgart game was another perfect example of it.
Yeah. Looks even more embarrassing now than it did.
Even in previous seasons when Bayern have won the title in January, they've never been beaten like that.
No,
not even, especially
not under Jupp Heynckes.
This was just embarrassed as well.
And I'm surprised at it under Heynckes because, yeah. I mean, we were talking a few weeks ago after the Leverkusen semi-final when Bayern was so clinical and so impressive.
Yeah.
Was that in between the Champions League semi-finals?
Or? Yeah, because that I wrote my the piece I wrote that
the
night.
Quarter-final
was
the semi-final, yeah.
It was in between the quarters and the semis, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. And we thought, this is, you know, they're approaching these games in such formidable sporting, footballing, yeah, and mental form. And all the players afterwards were talking about how uber concentrated and focused they are, and how Heynckes has got them in this zone where they're thinking of nothing else, and it was clear to see. And that's gone. That's what's disappeared.
That's what Real Madrid snapped.
And it shows Stuttgart have exploited it, and must be said, unlucky Stuttgart, because now that Frankfurt have won that 4-1 win in Munich got them into the Europa League until Frankfurt went and won the cup. But Bayern's slipping out of form is one of a number of factors which contributed to Frankfurt being able to do that, because Frankfurt all season, for all their qualities and for all Niko Kovac's qualities, they are a team where they do need it all to click. And there's been many a Frankfurt game this season where one factor of several hasn't quite been there and it's not worked out. Whether that's been, for example, Ante Rebic not performing, there's been games where he's not turned up. Whether it's been games where Marius Wolf has found himself too far wide and not able to dictate the play from the centre as much.
Or Radetzky error,
or Boateng losing his head.
Yep.
All sorts of factors around Eintracht Frankfurt, and that's, you know, that's what comes when you're a team which is, you know, still in very much in a state of rebuild. And it's not to take anything away from Niko Kovac, because it all came together in Berlin on Saturday night, and he thoroughly deserves it, and they thoroughly deserve it. So I don't think we can have complaints. I don't think Bayern Munich can have any complaints, certainly.
Do you think Frankfurt this was important for Frankfurt fans because Niko Kovac is leaving at the end of the season?
I think that plays a role that, you know, the coach is leaving, but I think most Frankfurt fans would say that they were probably disappointed that he wasn't honest, that he should have just said that he was negotiating
with
Bayern.
We talked about that, yeah.
And I think most of them will forgive him over time anyway, but this cup win this cup win is way bigger than Niko Kovac for Frankfurt fans. This isn't even about getting into Europe.
They've been waiting 30 years for a trophy.
Yeah, if you look at German football, this is the only way that you're going to win something now in German football if you're any other team than Bayern, right? So you know that the league isn't going to be a possibility, especially not for anyone, really, other than Bayern. So the cup is really your only route. And you're beating a Bayern side that knocked out Dortmund and Leipzig this year, right? So that's even more impressive. And for Frankfurt fans, I mean, you only needed to look at the way that the entire city, basically, was it 50,000 people, celebrated that victory in unbelievable fashion. And I think it was also, in some ways, I don't want to say a victory for German football, because that's a bit of a cliche, but I think a lot of people will have felt happy for Frankfurt and those scenes in a way that they might not have felt by watching Marienplatz
especially when you then see the comparative lack of reaction, lack of celebration, lack of enthusiasm in Munich. I think more people turned out for the police demo, didn't they?
So Frankfurt are going to have a new coach next season in Adi Hütte, and we found out today that and we're recording this on a Tuesday, that Lucien Favre is going to be the new coach of Borussia Dortmund. Now, Jonathan, you are holding your hands in your face. We actually asked thank you for all of you guys who voted in our poll on Twitter today. We got over almost 200 votes. That was incredible. I think that's the most successful poll we've had on our account. So thank you for voting in that. Most of you, almost, I think more than 2/3 or 3/4 of you, think that this is a good idea. But Jonathan, you just had your head in your hands. So would you like to explain why?
I think it's a tricky one. I'm curious to see whether Lucien Favre is any different from the way that I think many Bundesliga fans, journalists, will remember him. He was, or he is, for all intents and purposes, a very tricky character. And Max Eberl did a fantastic job of keeping the lid on him when he became difficult to manage or handle. I think it's part of the reason he was so successful at Gladbach is that he was in a very good team there. He arrives at Dortmund at an unbelievably critical stage for this club in terms of who's going, who's staying player-wise, but also structurally. You know, Watzke is wobbling in my opinion, in his seat. Zorc, his recruitment policy hasn't necessarily rendered the greatest quality of players in recent years. And that's what makes the arrival of Matthias Sammer in an advisory role, maybe less so, but Sebastian Kehl as well, very interesting, because perhaps it's Sebastian Kehl's job to keep Lucien Favre in a decent position or calm when he needs to be, because I cannot see Watzke, Zorc and Favre getting on particularly well over the course of a 34-game season plus Europe plus Cup, because they're all three of them are very dominant characters. They're all men who like to lead, who like to be the number one man in the room. And that just spells a real sense of potential friction between those characters.
See what happened the last time.
I mean,
Thomas Tuchel.
From a sporting perspective, I'm intrigued to see how he gets Dortmund playing, particularly remembering how he got Gladbach playing with Royce early on in those years. I'm really intrigued to see how that works out. But it'll also depend on who Dortmund buy and who Dortmund sell. But from a personal situation, from the way that he is as a coach, I'm worried about potential clashes. And the last thing that Dortmund need right now is more of that.
I'm wondering, you mentioned Marco Reus. Are we putting a little too much weight on the fact that that Lucien Favre has worked with Marco Reus once before? Because, I mean, he was a completely different player when he came through.
He was less injured,
and he's just not the same player.
No, I think I think it's worth putting the focus on Marco Reus and expecting great things of Marco Reus anyway, but not for the reason that he was brought through and given his chance at Gladbach by Lucien Favre.
I've seen that in so many places, and it just is.
If that's the reason for it, then no. But I think without a doubt, Marco Reus has to be focused upon as Borussia Dortmund's talisman.
But he was anyways.
And I think that's fine in that sense, but whether it's because of a specific relationship to Lucien Favre now, I'm not sure if that's particularly relevant anymore. As for I'm sure he'll play a key role. He's been key since his return from injury this season, and good luck to him. Hopefully he stays injury free, because he's fantastic to watch when he is fit. As for Favre himself, I understand John's concerns about it slightly. I think in the short term, it could turn out to be a decent decision, and they have only offered him a 2-year contract.
That's true.
A short term thing, and that's because I think although we can say that Borussia Dortmund have been in transition arguably ever since Klopp left.
Yeah.
I actually think the real transition starts now. Like you said, Vatska isn't just wobbling slightly in his position. He's also said in an interview with the Schwarzgelb fanzine last week that he's 65. He's not going to be there in 5 years' time. So he is paving the way for his own departure and his own succession. Michael Zorc has already said that he will be stepping down the sporting director, or at least moving across slightly in the hierarchy. So he'll be moving away from the sporting director role in a few years anyway, which is one of the reasons why they've brought Sebastian Kehl in, perhaps with the potential of
moving into that
role in a couple of years' time. The same will apply to Matthias Sammer, although it's still, I think, quite unclear what exactly an external advisor role entails. But from what I gather from what Vatska said in that interview, that it will be purely football-focused. So it won't be in terms of, he won't be involved in all the transfers or club politics, that sort of thing. It would purely football, technical, tactical, physical decisions. So yeah, I think the transition starts now. And I think that's why they've offered a coach like Favre, 60 years old, experienced, authoritarian, commands respect. They've offered something like a 2-year contract because it will tie them over in this period to get them to a point where they can then move on, but by which point they will have hopefully decided where they want to move on to. I don't think they've decided that yet, and that's been the issue with Dortmund all season and for the past few seasons, hasn't it, that we keep saying we don't know where they're going, they don't know what they want to be, and that's what they need to decide in the next 2 years. And I think that Favre could be a good decision in the short term to tie them over and before they then move on to a candidate, which I think the sort of candidate that everyone was screaming for this time, someone like a Nagelsmann, a Marco Rose, a Ralf Hasenhüttl, someone who considered more exciting.
Well, let me ask then.
The structures have to be in place first before they actually appoint a candidate like that.
Let me ask this to you, Jonathan. Is there a different direction that Borussia Dortmund could have gone that it would have been more attractive to you at this point in time?
I don't think it matters what I think.
Really. No, I'm just curious. I mean, it doesn't matter what any of us think, but it's, we're just doing a podcast, but it's, but I'm just curious if there was another direction that would make you not put your head into your hands.
No, my head in my hands and is not, in any way, shape, or form related to Lucien Favre's...
You guys couldn't see it, but it was rather theatrical.
Yeah, it's not related to Lucien Favre's coaching abilities. I think Matt makes an excellent point that for the short term, it's obviously not a bad move. There is a certain degree of argument that he's one of the few names left on the market that Dortmund would have considered / gone after, because obviously they paid for him and came to an agreement with Nice. But Matt's right. Dortmund are in a mess and they need to make sure that the structures are in place for the longevity of the club in terms of going in the right direction and, you know, stabilizing their position as the number two team in the country. They've certainly done that from a marketing perspective. They are without a doubt the number two team in Germany. They are far reaching. They have a lot of supporters around the world. Now they just need their sporting aspect to follow suit. Whether you consider that to be right or wrong is a whole other podcast in itself. But to do that, you need the right people in place. And I think Matthias Sammer is an excellent addition in terms of the technical and tactical support that he's going to provide. Even if it's literally just in that capacity, it's only going to do Dortmund, you know, a world of good. I think Sebastian Kehl is a player who knows the club and a lot of the structures and the players that might even be departing and can help with that transition. He's a great addition as well. But it's setting Dortmund up so that when a Nagelsmann type, and I think Nagelsmann could do an excellent job there,
providing the background is right for him.
When he does arrive, everything else is already in place so that his success is literally just down to him and the group of players and everything else doesn't have to be worried about. Because right now, the incoming manager, and Favre is definitely in this role, every other aspect of this club is in transition, is in need of repair, is in development. And that makes the coaching job harder because every question at a press conference, every question at training isn't just related to Saturday at Augsburg or your players. It's related to the chairman. It's related to the potential signings from the sporting director. It's related to who's the advisor, what are they saying? All of those questions will come for Dortmund. This is going to be a really bumpy ride the next year. But maybe they could have ridden it out, or they will ride it out, and then there'll be an opportunity for a more exciting manager. But could I have picked someone else? Is there anyone else that could have come in now? Nothing. You could have made it work with Nagelsmann now, but it would have been a much bigger risk.
Right. So basically, I don't want to continue to harp on this, but it seems like you both are saying, if I'm understanding this correctly, that Marco Rosa and Julian Nagelsmann, if either of them got the job,
yeah, just as examples, not necessarily saying that they would be bang on for the job, or
someone like that may not have been the best decision for Borussia Dortmund to make at this point.
No, not right now. I think if that had happened, it would have been just a complete repeat of what happened with Tuchel, what happened with Bosch.
Okay.
It's just taking a coach who's had success in the last 6 months to a year and assuming that they can apply that to the current squad.
They've had that success, though, and that's not just to disparage them, but we've said before in the podcast that one of the reasons why Nagelsmann does work so well is because of the team around him and the environment that he works in at Hoffenheim.
And he's been there a long time.
He knows the club.
And he knows the club. He's worked at youth level. He's got a great relation with Hop.
The same applies to Marco Rosa in Salzburg. It's there made for him, and there's nothing wrong with that. If you build the structures and it works, then fair play.
But if you're Borussia Dortmund,
there are no structures in place,
and you want those coaches, then A, you need the structures, but B, you need to make sure that when they're in place, that those incoming coaches are suited to those structures. If you don't build the right coliseum, it doesn't matter which gladiators you bring, they won't perform. So you can talk about Nagelsmann coming into Borussia Dortmund, but if you don't have the right structures for him, then it doesn't matter. So many coaches are successful because of the infrastructure that's around them, the team that works with them, and the fact that they've been there a long time. Look at the outcry in terms of support about Joachim Löw extending his contract as Germany head coach. Jürgen Klinsmann said it's fantastic that he's extended. Why? Because it's stability over a long period of time. And that makes a huge difference.
Germany loves their stability,
yeah,
too.
It does. And in some aspects of German culture, it's frustrating. It's infuriating. But if we're talking about football, there's a certain level of continuity. And it's one of the reasons that a lot of these young coaches, even, you know, Löw at a national level, are able to work for so long inside a club environment, because they are given the chance to develop a philosophy, to work with the right teams, to work with the right structures. And only over time can you achieve those goals. That's why Löw staying makes a lot of sense.
What do we expect now from Borussia Dortmund under Lucien Favre? Because they
transitional year. I mean, I
think one thing that any Dortmund fans listening shouldn't expect is a return to Jurgen Klopp, which is what at least the ones I speak to is what so many of them seem to want. And fair enough, why not? The sort of football he brought to Dortmund and the success it brought and the sort of football that he stands for. Yeah, why wouldn't you want that back? And that's certainly not going to come back under Lucien Favre. No. I think in terms of the style of play, it'll be probably slightly more similar to Thomas Tuchel, really, in terms of slightly more focus on possession of the ball and breaking teams down more intricately with more intricate passing rather than just hitting teams on the break. Dortmund have the players to do that, and that's not to say at all that Lucien Favre won't work at Dortmund. I think he's got every reason why it could. Let's not have Dortmund fans thinking, right, this is going to be a return to full throttle Jurgen Klopp football.
I'm also keen to see what happens over the summer, because I think a lot of players are going to move. I think a lot of change has got to come, and I'm very keen to see what Favre cuts from that squad and also what gets taken. Thomas Tuchel, in his interview at Paris Saint-Germain yesterday, couldn't have said anything nicer about Julian Weigl than he did. And he said, I don't know whether he's on the market. If he is, then we'll talk about it when he is. You know, what's going to happen to this Borussia Dortmund team, and what's it going to look like at the start of next season?
Well, so one thing I'm also really curious about is if everybody in Borussia Dortmund's squad was still on the team. We all don't think this is going to be the case because there's going to be, I think we all are of the opinion, I can speak for all of us, we think there's going to be some departures of some kind, whether it's somebody getting poached away from them or whether it's somebody that Borussia Dortmund just trying to move on for them. But given the squad that they have right now, who do you think is the player that would benefit from Lucien Favre the most? I want us all to name one.
Well, given looking at the way, I mean, yeah, okay, he's obviously changed the way that he's played, but I think if you look at Gladbach and the way that he had that front rolling, Royce and Hanke back in the day, and they were just amazing. And if you look more recently, how well he got Balotelli playing. I think that's also a real testament. I'd be very excited to see how Christian Pulisic is an obvious one, because I think he can play in some respects. He can be a great accomplishment to Marco Reus. But given Marco Reus's body of glass, I think I'd be most excited to see what Favre does with Sancho.
Okay.
No, taking the words out of my mouth, really. I think Favre did show at Gladbach that he can work with young players and he gets that balance right. So I don't think Christian Pulisic or Jadon Sancho should have anything to worry about at all. I think they can look ahead to next season quite confidently to be working under a coach who will hopefully know how to treat them and treat their development and get that right. And you mentioned Julian Weigl before. I'd also hope that's a player who can get back to form and refine his place in the team. I don't think it was easy for him. I think we underestimate sometimes, or we forget how young he actually is. Mm. He did make an impression under Tuchel, but then suddenly he found himself under Peter Bosz and found himself often in a system where he was left alone as maybe the only player protecting that back four, which for someone of his age was probably a little bit too much to ask. And then when Bosch's teams were exposed, as they so frequently were, that probably, understandably had a negative effect on Julian Weigl. And then suddenly to have to come back into the team in the sort of structures that Peter Stöger was seemingly trying to introduce. No one's entirely sure what he was trying to do there. It couldn't have been easy. So I would hope that, a slightly more tempered style of football that Lucien Favre could bring back to Dortmund could do Julian Weigl quite good as well.
What about Mahmoud Daoud?
Yeah, also a midfielder.
He's the one that I was thinking of, just because, you look at Granit Xhaka in Lucien Favre's team, even Christoph Kramer. A different type of player than Mahmoud Daoud, but someone box-to-box like Granit Xhaka. I realized too, obviously, that Mahmoud Daoud was there when Lucien Favre was there. Obviously, I don't know how many games he played under Lucien Favre.
I think there's maybe a potential issue there in terms of personality. Daoud will need to show Favre that he has matured. I don't think it's going to do him any favors if he's not, fully committed to the cause. I mean, I'm not suggesting that he hasn't been in the past, but he hasn't always played. And there was, when he was at Gladbach, he had that falling out with Schubert, and I think he's not always the easiest player to manage. I think he'll be one of the tests for Favre and whether he can make the most of him. He's obviously talented, but he doesn't really play that often, and there are some question marks why. Towards the end of the season at Dortmund, he was looking really good. Whether he can be the starter or not, because obviously consider the potential moves. If Weigl does go and Shahin maybe leaves, you're looking relatively thin. Then you've got the striking thing. I mean, who have you got? Maxi Philipp. I mean, you've got Yarmolenko as well, but he's kind of a winger.
I think Andre Schürrle played up top against against Hoffenheim, didn't
he? That's the thing. You've got Schürrle, you've got Isak, who
scraping the bottom of the barrel a little bit.
Still looks a little raw. So again, it's going to be very telling to see who Dortmund bring in the summer. But yeah, there will be players like Daoud, like Royce, like Sancho, like Pulisic, that will certainly be keen to be a part of a side that plays attacking football under Lucien Favre, but they'll have to get it right with their mental approach.
All right, that'll do it for this week's edition of Tribuna Weekly. A little programming note, we will be doing World Cup podcasts, so be sure to stay tuned for that. We'll be focusing mostly on the German national team, but also touching on other topics as well. And if there's stuff you want to talk about on the German national team, you can always contact us on Twitter at Tribuna Podcast and on our Tribuna Podcast Facebook page. Also, be sure to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts. And if you do, please leave us a friendly review. You can find Matt Ford on Twitter at Matt_4D, Jonathan Harding at JohnBlog66, 2Ds and 2Sixes. Boy, that's good to say again. And I'm at Davis_VanOptdorp. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon.